Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
So it's a very big day in the day ahead. If you're in Wisconsin, there are over 500 members of the National Guard standing by as the Kyle Rittenhouse trial is nearing its end today. Closing arguments are starting this morning, and then jury deliberations will follow soon after. The 18-year-old is accused of killing two men and injuring a third in what he called self-defense back in the protests in August of 2020. Joining us now is Bill Bloss, and I want to make it very clear right out of the gate that Bill Bloss is an attorney with Koskoff, Koskoff, and Beter. Bill has absolutely nothing to do with this case, okay? He is not representing anyone. He has no connections to this case. But Bill has come on in the past as our legal expert to just give us outlook, perspective on these national cases. And that's what we're doing this morning. Bill, thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So let's actually date back to what actually happened in August of 2020. These were riots that came after a police-involved shooting and killing of an African-American man. What can you tell us about the, like, just this scenario and where Rittenhouse plays a part in it?
Well, you know, this is a really unusual case, frankly, where no facts are in dispute in terms of what happened, who did what. Mm-hmm. It's almost all of it was on videotape. He testified that he came to Kenosha as a patriot, to use his term, to try to protect local businesses that were being threatened in the rioting. He crossed state lines with an AR-15 gun, and then the shootings happened. That much is absolutely not in dispute. What's in dispute is whether he was reasonably acting in self-defense, or believed he was acting in self-defense at the time he fired his weapon.
And what's interesting about this case, Bill, is depending on who you talk to and depending on what evidence is compelling for people, some see Kyle as being a hero and others see him as a vigilante. How does that happen in a case like this?
You know, Melissa, I think that's just reflective of what's going on in society more generally. I mean, this has turned into a red or blue event, right? Depending on what group or what tribe people feel they belong to right now. It's really just a reflection of what's happening in the country at large, I think.
So you think, depending on your political view, people will either see this man as acting in self-defense or that he went out there with the intention to kill people?
Well, even if he didn't go out there with the intention to kill people, and that's actually an important question, because the judge is going to allow the jury to consider charges less than intentional homicide. You know, but here the problem, I mean, both sides have a problem, honestly. The defense has a problem in that he went there with a high-powered semi-automatic rifle that he was not legally allowed to carry because he's 17. I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence talking about how much training he has in an AR-15. I'm willing to bet that it's not very much. Does he have training in use of force? I would doubt it. So on the one hand, he instigated some of these confrontations. And once he started shooting, what are other people supposed to do? Are they just supposed to stand by and let him keep shooting? Those people who tried to take the gun away from him, what are they supposed to do? On the other hand, you know, we do forget that there were riots in Kenosha. There were businesses that were being destroyed. It was an extraordinarily tense time, and so there were people who were out there protecting car dealerships and stores and so forth. So, you know, this is a case that involves perspective. What perspective? What fact do you weigh more as more important in that analysis?
And I'm curious, Bill Bloss, again, is our attorney, our legal expert on the show, but has absolutely no affiliation or connection to the Rittenhouse trial. I'm curious, Bill, my understanding was this was the third night of riots that were going on in Wisconsin. Do we know if Rittenhouse, because I don't think they've made that clear, was this the first night he had shown up, or was this after two other nights of being there, quote unquote, patrolling, if you will, that the third night, that's when the killings happened?
So I haven't heard that he was there on the first two nights, and I think that would have come out.
Yeah.
That would certainly be a fact, right? If you'd been there peacefully two other nights, and then the third night something happened, I mean, I think I would have brought that out if I was on the defense, but
I would too,
I didn't
right.
hear that.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm not sure, but you know, but there was violence in Kenosha. There's no question mm-hmm. about it. But you know, the question is, did he come there to help instigate more violence and insert himself in a place he just should not have been with a weapon he should not have had? Or was he defending law-abiding business owners in Kenosha who were being threatened with serious property losses? Now, whether that justifies, by the way, whether that justifies shooting and killing people, you know, that's a problem the defense has.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the chances are, Bill, that they do lessen his charges to reckless endangerment versus intention to kill?
Well, I think the fact that the prosecution asked for the reduced charges is probably some indication about how the prosecution feels that evidence is gone. If they were confident of an intentional homicide charge, they would not have made that request. I think that there's a very high chance of a mixed verdict here. Guilty on some counts, not guilty on other counts, involving different victims. In other words, the use of force, he's got four different either shots or attempted shots or attempted victims. And so I think that there could well be a difference on some of the counts depending on what the victims did, how they and what they did that led to him shooting them. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
We're chatting with Bill Bloss, who's an attorney with Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter, and we're getting some legal perspective on the Rittenhouse trial. That is the closing arguments are actually happening today. It's about 2.5 hours per side, and then soon after there will be jury deliberations. First of all, Bill, really quick on this. By the way, Bill is not connected to this case whatsoever. He's just our legal expert. Bill, curious, what are the chances that the jury starts deliberating this afternoon?
Oh, 100%. Well, I guess when I say 100%, I don't mean it. But I would say the likelihood is pretty high.
Okay.
Although, you know, they've got some preliminary things to do. They'll have to elect a foreperson. They'll have to get the exhibits together. And part of it depends on how long the closing arguments last. The prosecution has said that they really are going to take the 2.5 hours the judge is going to allow them, which is a long time for a closing argument.
Mm-hmm.
The defense is saying only 1.5 hours. And then so, you know, and then you're going to have the judge's instructions. So, you know, the jury could start chatting. I don't know that they'll actually start deliberating. It's going to be a complicated verdict sheet, I think.
Mm-hmm. So my question with this case, because unfortunately I hate that race has to be included, but I do feel like with these major cases, when you have these massive shootings that happen or these very violent protests that happen, it feels like kind of back to what you were saying in the beginning of our chat, Bill, that, you know, with our climate now in this country, people focus on race, and you've got a now 18-year-old white man who, you know, shot and killed two white men and injured another white male. And I'm curious, not that race should have anything to do with it, but depending on how the verdict lands, essentially, you know, what is that going to say, I guess? So let's just say they lessen his charge to reckless endangerment. Do you think that the judge is taking into consideration his age, his race? Like, do you think those things are being taken into consideration? Because you know there's going to be public outcry, especially the fact that he's a white guy. To put it simply, I'm just trying to be blunt, honestly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and actually you could even back up a little bit if you wanted to ask that question, because, you know, you've seen pictures of this guy walking down the streets of Kenosha with an AR-15. If he was a 17-year-old black guy, would the police have just like
allowed him to walk?
And,
right.
Legally, the answer is yes. Practically, can you say the answer is yes with a high degree of certainty? I don't know. I mean, that's certainly debatable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, your question is a good one. And I think the way it's gone in, you know, given that the victims were white, the way it's gone in is that it hasn't had that component to it, I think, in terms of the narrow evidence in the case. But it's also out there. As you noted, that the reason that the whatever you want to call them, either patriots or vigilantes, depending on your perspective, the reason they were there was because of a police involved shooting with a black man, mm-hmm. that many people in Kenosha felt was unjustified. So it's impossible to think about this case without that backdrop. How important that's going to be to the jury, I don't know. The evidence hasn't gone in a way that has made race a defining factor, but it's, you know, it's always there.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, Bill, before I let you go, again, if they do lessen his charge from the intent to kill, you know, with these homicides versus reckless endangerment, my understanding is if he were to go with the initial, if the verdict came down and said, yes, he had the intent to kill, that's a lifetime prison sentence, I believe. So what would it mean if they lessened his charge? Any idea?
Well, the reckless manslaughter is still a serious charge. Mm-hmm. So if this, he is going to get convicted of carrying a weapon or a semi-automatic rifle by a minor. But that's only a misdemeanor in Wisconsin, interestingly.
Wow.
So he probably doesn't even get time for that. But if he gets convicted of a reckless homicide, it's kind of the equivalent of what in Connecticut would be a manslaughter, then he is likely looking at a prison sentence despite his age. So this is a very high stakes day, obviously, not only for the people of Kenosha, but also for Rittenhouse and people who support him. It's it's hard to see a complete victory for anybody, frankly, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. me. But we'll see. This is why we have trials.
Right. Right. Well, Bill Bloss, our legal expert, attorney with Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter, we always appreciate having you on the show to give us perspective. Again, want to just let everyone know who's listening. Bill has no connection to this case, but we always appreciate getting his perspective on some of these national cases. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure, Melissa.
All right. That's, again, Bill Bloss with Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter. There is an effort right now to preserve Remington Woods. Remington Woods. We've talked about Remington a few times. It is 422 acres, with 347 of that in Bridgeport, the remainder in Stratford. Forests, wetlands, meadows, vernal pools, and a sparkling 23-acre lake is home to diverse wildlife, including birds, mammals, fish, fox, frogs, ducks, deer, you name it. And it's just a beautiful piece of property, including even Senator Blumenthal saying that he would like it to stay a national reserve on the registry. And joining us now to continue talking about Remington Woods is Maria Pereira. She is a city councilwoman in Bridgeport. And Maria, correct me if I'm wrong, but you, a lot of the people that you represent in that district, they are directly impacted by Remington Woods and what happens. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on this morning. The 347 acres in Bridgeport, probably 95% of it is specifically located in the district I represent, which is in the 138 district, with a very small sliver of it going into the 139 district, which is considered the East End.
Okay. So, Maria, from your perspective, you've obviously been following this very closely. I would imagine you also would like to preserve this property.
Yes, and more importantly, my constituents want it preserved. Bridgeport's celebrating its 200th birthday this year. And if we haven't developed it in 200 years, what is the desperate need to develop it now? There's always a big push to preserve open space in rural areas and suburbs. But really, the people who need to preserve open space, especially a natural forest, are dense populated polluted urban cities. It's important to our physical, mental, spiritual well-being. In addition, we've had unprecedented flooding in this district over the last 15 months. I mean, I've had people who not once but twice have lost all their furnaces, their hot water tanks, washing machine and dryers, tons of damage and mold in their basements. And what we know is climate change is real. And by taking away 100 or 1,000 trees and putting down asphalt and pavement to develop the woods will only exacerbate flooding. So based on climate change, nobody should be, removing forests. We should be doing everything in the world to preserve them.
Maria, I'm curious, because you've been serving the city of Bridgeport in more ways than just being a city councilwoman for many, many years. I have pressed Mayor Ganim, for example, other city officials on development plans. And my understanding is now that we know that somebody owns that property and that it's been going under a lot of cleanup efforts. But now that that's coming to a close, my understanding, and this is where I'd love for you to tell me otherwise, is that there are no development plans on the table, at least that have been made public knowledge. Have you heard otherwise?
Well, yeah. First of all, it's officially owned by DuPont, who then asserts it's owned by Corteva, and Corteva asserts it's a bunch of shell corporations.
Mm-hmm.
But DuPont, most people will know, as a multi-billion-dollar chemical company who has a horrible environmental record, horrible employee safety record with OSHA, and a horrible labor record. I don't think anybody should entrust DuPont or any of its subsidiaries in the development of land that's completely bordered by residential homes and properties. Now, I will tell you, I joined one of their quarterly meetings just a couple of weeks ago, and actually the representatives, they're not even happy with what's being proposed. It's being proposed to move from light industrial to office park development and residential. Corteva, DuPont, whatever shell corporation you want to reference, they literally want it zoned for a convention center and a hotel, which is pretty outrageous, seeing that this is completely surrounded by residential properties and a large portion of our public schools, and the largest bastion of senior and disabled housing, literally in Bridgeport, literally borders Remington Woods. So this would be completely unacceptable to my constituents. And let's remember that Remington Woods, yes, it directly impacts my constituents because it's predominantly in my district.
Mm-hmm.
But there are health benefits to all of Bridgeport and beyond. And so it's critically important that we all work to preserve it in its entirety. None of it should be developed.
What do people like Senator Blumenthal and the many who support preserving it, what do they suggest happens? Like, you know, I know Senator Blumenthal had said on our show he would be fine with the idea of like a walking path, like making some kind of, designated walking path through there. But, you know, what are some of the things being brought from the side of preservation? What are some of the big things that are being argued to maybe stop development from happening?
Well, I will tell you, it was actually former State Representative Chris Caruso who recommended have legislation introduced at the federal level to make it a federal nature preserve. And when we raised that topic with Senator Blumenthal, he thought it was a great idea. He often references the preserve in Fairfield for Stuart McKinney. So he's really on board with it. But first things first, we have this public hearing tomorrow at 6 o'clock. Let me be clear. The hearing's not specifically about Remington Woods. They've been working for a couple of years now on rewriting all our zoning regulations. So tomorrow there's a public hearing on what's called Zone Bridgeport, which is 300 pages of new zoning regulations. But in those regulations, one of the things they've done is they've changed the zoning of Remington Woods for light industrial, which it made sense because it was owned by Remington, the arms manufacturer. But it's never been developed. and they want to change it to the development of residential and office and an office park. And we don't want that. We want it to go to a new designation, which is called P1, which is parks open space. And so that's where we are. Our state senator Bradley is on board. So is State Representative Stallworth, who represents a portion of my district. And I believe State Rep Andre Baker is on board as well. We're still working with him. And so there, you know, most of the elected officials who directly impact Remington Woods and its and the constituents who border it seem to be on board mm-hmm. with the preservation of it in its entirety, which is good. It's mm-hmm. rare that you see all different factions and politicians, you know, pretty united on something like this.
Absolutely. Well, Maria, I know we have run out of time, but if anybody wants to get in on this hearing, if they want to be able to still give testimony, it's still early on in the decision making. Is there a way people can get involved?
Right. So tomorrow night, there's a 6 p.m. virtual planning and zoning public hearing on the new zoning regulations. It's at 6 o'clock p.m. What's great is you can join from your sofa or your kitchen table. You don't have to leave your home. And if you want access to the agenda, you would just Google or do a search Bridgeport Planning and Zoning Public Hearing, or you can Google Bridgeport City Council Agendas, which allows you to hit a drop-down menu and click on Planning and Zoning. So it's really easy to find the information. And I hope as many people as possible take a few minutes out of their night tomorrow just to get on and talk about the importance of preserving Remington Woods.
Mm-hmm. And if anyone does want more information, a really great website, Preserve Remington Woods, all spelled out, preservereMingtonWoods.com, is also available if you want to check that out. Maria Pereira, we so appreciate you coming on this morning. Thank you so much. And would love to have you back on soon to get an update on this.
Okay, thank you so much.
Absolutely. I'm going to tell you right now, Bob was not messing around this week. Good grief. Are you brave enough, interested in enough, bold enough to ask and answer this question? Are you feeding or sabotaging your marriage? Wow, Bob. What's eating you? What's going on? That's a very intense question to ask someone. You're out for blood today, Bob. Whew.
Well, what do you think?
I think if people are being honest, I'm sure we've all sabotaged our marriage in one way or another. None of us are perfect. So I would imagine if we're being honest, we've all sabotaged it. But gosh, I mean, I'm hoping in the current state of mind with my husband listening to this, I'm hoping I'm feeding my marriage. I hope I am. Now you got me feeling all insecure, Bob. Thanks a lot.
No, come on. I know you guys, and I know you feed it more than sabotage it. I know that. Well, the first clue might be an unwillingness to even ask that question, right?
Sure.
By just not be willing to ask that question or face it and discuss it, that might be something right there that says you might be sabotaging your marriage. Because, as you know, right, marriages are they're a living, dynamic relationship that
you
look at it this way, the things you do either feed it or drain it. Like, you really do. There's no neutral, right?
Marriage
doesn't stay neutral.
Right.
So, yeah, that's why I thought about this. I thought it was a good way to kind of frame it.
I like it. I think it's a great topic. And you're right. I think you do have to be brave enough and willing to do anything for your marriage to really look in the mirror and go, what am I doing? What am I actually doing in my marriage?
Yeah.
A hard question.
You know, the easiest way to look at this, it really is how you spend your time. That's the easiest way to look at this because, right, we all have so much time together, and how do you spend it? So that's kind of the first way I looked at this. And the way I looked at this, I kind of segmented it into three categories, like things that I like to do, things that I like to join my spouse in doing, and then things that we can find to do. So I kind of bucket it in those ways. And, you know, as you said, like, you know, many of us probably do sabotage our marriage in one way or another. So the first thing is that you have an overemphasis on things that you like to do. You know, my hobbies, you know, I'm working too much, that I'm seeing my friends too much. I'm meeting with people that have my interests. So it's, you know, say it's like my. So that's kind of the first thing that might be a clue that if there's an overemphasis on things that you're doing, you know, not a good thing. So
Yeah, that's one thing. Then the other thing would be, do you look for ways to join your spouse in what he or she likes to do?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a big one, because, I mean, again, my early marriage, I was an only child, so I did a lot of things just that I like to do, and that didn't go well. So I learned right off the bat, you know, focusing on things I like to do wasn't healthy for things that we like to do. So I've grown over the years. And
so
a great example I've used, and I love it because, you know, Karen calls it retail therapy. I mean, she loves to browse and shop. And I'll make one thing perfectly clear. She does not spend a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she loves to look at bargains. And nothing pleases me more than we go out and I see her coming from a store with a bag. I mean, I love that.
Because, you know, she's happy. Yeah.
And, well, she's happy because she's bought, like, you know, a pair of pants, a pair of shirt, and something else for like $50.
Right. She found a deal. Right.
She loves doing that. So I just go and I love to watch her enjoy that.
I have to say, Bob, it's you know, this lesson, if I'm being honest, and you and I have talked about this before, but this idea of finding out what the other person loves, I will honestly say, I don't want to say it saved our marriage, but it definitely was one of the, I think, integral parts of going from just going through the motions and actually deeply connecting with your spouse was a lesson
right.
I learned from you and Karen when you guys told us in our class, like, simply think of one thing your spouse is really interested in, like really passionate about, and take the time to get interested in it. And at first, Derek and I are like, oh, God. What? Like, just let him do his thing. I'll do my thing. It's fine. But it was, I have to be honest, like 5 years later, it's amazing because now, you know, Derek's thing was the Boston Bruins. My thing was obviously Disney. And now I just can't tell you how many different decisions we have made in our lives that have surrounded the passion that the other one loves. And we've grown to love those passions too. Like, it's amazing how that's happened.
That's right. But the key was changing kind of your heart, right? What you thought about it, right? Like, when you're both kind of like, I want to get more into Disney. I want to get more into what, you know, the Bruins and everything. That does change. Even, I'm telling you, even this shopping example, like, I just love to, like, see her happy doing, you know, shopping and finding these bargains, you know?
Right.
And this is one that is easy to do that has immense benefits. And that's what marriage should be. You should look for things that are easy to have a big impact. And,
right.
How you spend your time is something that that does work. And also just recognizing traps. Like, wow, I had one, you know, last year where I grew up on boats. I love boats. I always dreamed of having a boat, but it doesn't make sense here in Connecticut.
Right.
But I found a boat club that you can actually pay and use boats. I said, wow, right? But I saw that as a trap because I could easily get sucked into that. So I brought Karen right into that. And we really worked right through that, like not spending too much. It was a trap.
Interesting.
It was a trap.
That's right. Weird to even look at it that way, Bob, because that's something that you love. But what you saw was, this is going to take away from me, including my wife. That's so interesting. Totally. Wow.
Yep. A lot of traps. Huh. Like, video games is a trap. A lot of sports is a trap. You know, working, like getting a promotion.
Getting
turned
into your work. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, great topic to look at how you spend your time.
Here's the question this morning. Are you feeding or sabotaging your marriage? And our marriage consultant, Bob Donovan, is here. We were just talking about being intentional about how you spend your time. What else do you have for us this morning, Bob? Some other things that you can keep an eye out for to make sure you are not sabotaging your marriage.
Yeah, another one I just say is by taking your spouse for granted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at just managing a house, and whether you have small kids or teenagers or even no kids and just work, like whatever it is. But, and here's the question, in your heart, what do you think about your spouse? Are you in your heart thinking, I do more than him or her? I work more than him or her? Like, do you think that in your heart? So that's where I want to go with this. Like, what do you believe about your spouse in your heart? Because so often that's where it starts. And then do you tell them or show them based on what they need about how much you appreciate them? You're bringing up the love languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
A person that has words of affirmation. I just had a conversation with this with a couple last week. A person, because he had words of affirmation, and I said, you know, a person that has words of affirmation, you can't say thank you enough. You can't. And then she rolled her eyes. She goes, that's true. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
So if a person has words, then you really need to be deliberate about thanking them and showing them how much you appreciate. Now, my wife doesn't have words of affirmation. She has acts of service.
Mm-hmm.
So for Karen, she feels valued when I jump in and show her by doing things.
Mm-hmm.
See, but it starts in the heart. It starts in the heart. That's where, you know, that this next point goes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another one that, boy, this caught me. This is a little surprise. I was talking to a husband last week about, they were struggling a little bit. And I said, well, what do you want for your wife? Like, what would you prefer? And he said, my number one thing would be for her to take care of herself.
Oh, wow. Well, because I'm sure it's a trickling effect. If she can't take care of herself, how could she take care of him? Yeah,
exactly. And again, you look at their life stage. They have an infant, they have a toddler, and she's just drained, right?
Yeah.
And he said, more than anything else, I wish she'd take care of herself.
But, you know, sometimes that's hard to believe. I've got to be honest, Bob, that's hard to believe sometimes. And it's not because we don't believe our spouses, but there will be days, and I think to myself, what are you doing? There will be days where Derek will do something that just to me, I think to myself, you know, why? Like, why do I deserve that? And he's like, because I love you. But I think to myself, yeah. But what do you want out of that? Like, I don't know if as humans we just always think like, okay, but what's the catch here? But I do think as and I don't know if either females or males or you know maybe some people don't feel this way. But for me, I still, you know, 13 years later, I'm always like, but what do you want out of this? And he's like, literally nothing, but you're annoying me because you keep asking.
Yep.
So I'm just going to stop.
Yep.
You know, why do we think like that? Why do we naturally think our spouse wouldn't want what's best for us? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I do totally. And I do think this has a gender component. I really do. I just, again, from doing this for so many years, in general, most moms, wives, women never feel like they're doing enough.
Yeah.
Whether they work or stay home, like they're never enough, never a good mom. They're never a good worker and mom. They're never that women for whatever reason. And are always trying to like make it up by doing more. And until they take a breath and take a pause, like, and do something to fill you up. Really, I think there is a gender component to this that you think that if I do something for myself, I'm taken away from, you know, my son or my husband even. So, I do think there's a component of this. And I think it's a great topic to talk about because you each need to take care of yourself. And again, think about this. Fill yourself up so you can be the best you can be to your spouse and to your kids. So, but I think, you know, I think it's the gender component, but I also think many of us have this too, thinking that the way I call it is you need a balanced, appropriate approach to taking care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Balance is right because you can't be crazy working out.
Right, but you also can't be like, okay, I deserve to be at the spa 6 days a week because, you know.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
I birthed your kid 5 years ago. Right.
Exactly right.
Yeah,
exactly
I get that.
Right. Yeah.
I get that.
And you have to recognize your life stage, right? Because if you're like, you know, you have a small son, you're working, like, you know, you can't do a lot, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
You can't do a lot.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. I know, but I do love that idea of self-care. And even if it's something like, you know, going to get a massage once a month, or maybe it is going to, you know, out to dinner with your spouse or something, you know, something like that, where you do take a step back and go, hey, you know, maybe it's not something we could do frequently, but it is important that we do it. Or you're not taking care of yourself and your needs and your, you know, your self-care does go down the drain a little bit. And Bob Donovan is here. If you're just tuning in, he is our marriage consultant on the show. Bob, I see here failing to express your negative emotions. Oh, boy, that's a hard one.
Yeah. And I think, again, I'm not sure this is that gender. I think men generally struggle with this more. But I'm just finding more recently, typically in a marriage, there's more of a private person and more public person. Mm-hmm. One's more verbal. One's more nonverbal, right?
Yes.
So it doesn't have to be gender. But basically, and you think about this question that so often the private person just, for whatever reason, just keeps things to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, what I've seen is that by even the little things, it's the drip, drip, drip. But when you do that, when you bury emotions and don't express them in a healthy way, at some point they come out in a big way in an inappropriate time.
Mm-hmm.
So And then really what you're doing here by not expressing your negative emotions is you're not trusting your spouse.
Yeah, essentially you are sabotaging your marriage. Right. Because what's the bigger message here? Yeah.
Right.
That's
yeah.
So true.
And again, the Bible says that we are to know and to be known to each other. So this is a way to do that, like to trust your spouse with, hey, I'm feeling this way. And again, you're not making a judgment. You're just expressing an emotion and then just getting that out. Like, mm-hmm. It's, again, these are little things that have big impact in a marriage.
It's so true. And Bob, I'm just curious, for anybody who wants to reach out to you and talk more about this, again, it's a very raw subject, but it is something that's very important and could make or break a marriage. How do they contact you?
Yeah, best way would be email bdonovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N at blackrock.org.
All right. Well, Bob, we appreciate your time always. Thank you so much. And we'll talk again in a couple of weeks.
Great, Melissa.
Thanks, Bob. We appreciate it.
Patty Asai. She is known as the Duchess of Decorum, and she's a social media influencer for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of followers. Good morning, Patty. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first and foremost, Patty, what are some of the biggest things you want people to look out for as etiquette is concerned heading into Thanksgiving?
One of the biggest things I think people have forgotten, because we haven't been visiting people's homes, is if you're going over to someone's home for Thanksgiving, ask them if you can bring something. If they say no, bring something anyway. You never want to show up to anyone's home empty-handed, so you want to make sure that you take a host or hostess gift. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be expensive, but just something to show your appreciation.
Now, how do you feel about people addressing COVID? For example, if you're going, like, for example, I'm going to my in-laws in a couple of weeks, and I have not gone to their house since before COVID. Is it appropriate to say, hey, are there certain things you need from me in order to feel safe? Or does that seem a little too over the top?
Absolutely. I think especially that since COVID is still happening and is not over yet, I think it's very courteous of the guests to ask about COVID protocols. What are the COVID protocols? Are you requiring us to be vaccinated, or are the guests being vaccinated? I think that's perfectly acceptable. And I think the host can also mandate or dictate that their guests be vaccinated as well. I think people forget that you have the right to do that for the safety of everyone.
Now, what about, Patty, if you are, for example, you're going to see people maybe for the first time in over a year, 2 years, and let's be honest, there's been a lot of things that have happened in the news and around the world in the last couple of years, and frankly, for some reason, when we all get together, a lot of times, I'd say those controversial things come up. Now, would you recommend even bringing up those subjects at the Thanksgiving dinner table, or how do you sort of proceed? How do you handle those awkward conversations? You know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. And I've been a part of those conversations. So yes, I know what you're talking about. So yes, do not talk religion or politics. That's just the number one rule. Let's not do that at Thanksgiving. This is not a time to have those discussions. However, there'll be some people that will not abide by the rule and will start talking about either one of those two things. And what we want to do is you just want to ignore these conversations. If someone brings it up, just politely say yes. Just nod your head and do not engage in the conversation, because eventually they will stop talking about it. They will get the hint, and everyone can be happy versus it escalating to something that doesn't need to be, especially during the holidays.
The Duchess of Decorum is here, Patty Asai, who is a social media influencer, and she specifies in etiquette for her hundreds of thousands of followers online. So, Patty, what are some topics that you would recommend are good ideas, maybe some good conversation starters?
So I think good conversation starters are talking about, you know, people themselves. I think we forget that one of the most important things that we're doing in the holidays is engaging one-on-one, especially since we haven't been together. So I think we should ask people, how have you been doing the past year? How was your job? How are your kids? Just ask them about who they are and what they're doing. And I think that is the best way to connect with people, especially, you know, since we haven't been together for so long.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about as a guest, when you are there, what do you expect as just classic etiquette when you're invited to someone's house? Especially, I find this, if it's a family's home, a lot of times, you know, we'll kind of fall into old times, like, hey, I'm going to mom and dad's house, so I'm going to kick back and I'm not going to do anything. What would be your suggestions, especially if you're going to a family's home? Do you still offer to, like, do the dishes? I mean, it probably sounds really silly, but, like, what would be your etiquette advice on that?
Yes, you absolutely offer to do dishes, even if you're going to someone that's not a family member. That is proper etiquette. After everyone's finished eating, you don't get it from the table until everyone's finished. Then everyone gets up, and the men and women should be asking the host or hostess, may I help with the dishes? May I help clean up? Because as we know, I mean, it's insane after Thanksgiving in the kitchen, right? It just looks like a bomb blew up in there. So, yes, you absolutely should be helping.
And I guess the last thing, if you could kind of dive into some proper table manners, you know, what are some of the biggest things, the biggest no-nos you typically find that maybe we should know better how to handle?
Sure. So here are just a few. First, when you were invited to someone's home, and if you're someone's home and you're getting ready to sit down for Thanksgiving dinner, you don't just go and plop yourself down in a chair. You have to wait for the host and hostess to take their seat, and then you take your seat. And if there's something on the table that you want, you don't just reach over. What you do is you ask for it to be passed, and everything at the dinner table is passed to the right or counterclockwise. Another thing that people really don't know is that when you're making a toast, you're not supposed to clink your glasses. That's considered poor etiquette.
Wait,
what? You're supposed to just, yes, you're not supposed to, because you're not supposed to make any sound with your utensils or glasses or anything like that.
Where did that come from then? Wait. Patty, now you're throwing me off. Wait a minute. So when people say cheers, that's actually not proper etiquette? You're blowing my mind right now.
Yes, you can say cheers, but you're not supposed to clink glasses because you're not supposed to make any sound with your utensils or your glasses or anything like that. That's proper etiquette.
Oh, my gosh. So where did that come from? Who started breaking the rules? Because we definitely are big offenders of that. We clink all the time. Oh, no.
Yes. From what I understand, it was the Americans that started clinking their glasses first.
Oh, there you go.
And, that's from what I understand. And, again, I don't know specifically who changed it, but I know that that's not proper etiquette. And also, most people don't know this, if there is a toast being made in your honor, you're not supposed to drink, because that shows that you're celebrating yourself and you're being braggadocious, and that's not considered proper etiquette.
Oh, no. Okay, well, I'm breaking so many rules.
Now you know.
Now I know. Okay, well, Patty, I so appreciate getting your insight. I know you have so many other tips. Where can people go if they want to follow your accounts, they want to learn more and interact with you?
Sure. I am at Duchess of Decorum on Instagram and on TikTok. And if you go to my TikTok channel, there is all the links to my websites and everything else that I'm doing. So you can find me there, Duchess of Decorum.
Patty Asai, thank you so much for your time this morning. I hope to connect with you again really soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Melissa. Have a great day.